Help retrain your appetite with AIDS. Available from leading chemists in your area.
Hello, I'm Douglas Cameron, and this is the Independent Radio News Review of 1982.
Can hear the bullets now whizzing around us, ricocheting off the rocks. A heavy salvo of small arms fire, machine gun fire coming both down the hill and then up the hill in reply from the British troops.
How are you?
First Mary Rose timbers break through the Solent.
I must believe and delight in this marvellous. It's rather a grown-up thing, I find. Rather a shock to my system. He's in marvellous form.
Does the baby have any hair?
It's marvellous.
This is Moscow. The Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR, and the Council of Ministers of the USSR deeply regret to announce the sudden death of Leonid Brezhnev.
Before dawn, buildings shook and the sky turned yellow and orange as ceasefire number 8, just over 30 hours old, broke down.
And the band, the thing seemed to lift up. And I saw the band people, what I do in the air.
Some of the sounds of the year just ending, sounds which really were part of the news of 1982. In a year which was dominated by the Falklands, it's sometimes something of a surprise to hear of events which feel as if they happened in a different age. That word, Falklands, is already part of our history. But what of these words? Had you heard of them or used them in conversation before the last 12 months? Exocet, positive vetting, rah-rah, total allergy syndrome, Popemobile. We all now know what they are. They're all part of a momentous year. A year which our defence correspondent Paul Maurice will always remember for the period when that tiny group of islands in the South Atlantic dominated every news bulletin for 3 months.
It's 5 o'clock. This is Bill Bingham. Argentina has invaded the Falkland Islands, and its marines have taken control of the colony, which has been in British hands for almost 150 years.
Throughout the day, both the Ministry of Defence and the Foreign Office have been denying the Argentine reports of an invasion. It was a theme we became used to during the next 2.5 months. That was on Friday, April the 2nd. By Tuesday, the aircraft carriers, Hermes and Invincible, and about 50 other warships had assembled at Plymouth and Portsmouth. With them went just as many merchant ships to carry the troops and vehicles and to refuel the warships. It was a motley group. The Canberra and the Uganda, later the QE2, and also roll-on, roll-off ferries, container ships, tugs and trawlers.
Of the Welsh Guards plays on the quayside as the troops file onto the ship. Since first light, a stream of trucks have brought the 3,000 men.
The exact size of the task force and the number of troops was kept a closely guarded secret. The experts worked out that the fleet could be there 8,000 miles away in about 3 weeks. But on the morning of April the 12th, John Knott, the Secretary of State for Defence, revealed that Britain already had some power to call on in the South Atlantic.
Outer limit of this zone is a circle of 200 nautical mile radius from approximately the centre of the Falkland Islands. Any Argentine warships and Argentine naval auxiliaries found within this zone will be treated as hostile and are liable to be attacked by British forces.
On April the 25th, Royal Marines retook South Georgia, sinking the Argentine submarine, the Santa Fe, in the process. Mrs. Thatcher was with Mr. Knott when he gave the news.
The commander of the operation has sent the following message.
be pleased to inform Her Majesty that the White Ensign flies alongside the Union Jack in South Georgia. God save the Queen.
What happens next? What if not?
Thank you very much.
What's your reaction?
Rejoice at that news and congratulate our forces and the Marines.
Are we going
good
to declare war on Argentina, Mr. Thatcher?
Soon the task force was in a position to pull the cordon tight around the Falklands. By this time, the shuttle between Washington, Buenos Aires and London by United States Secretary of State Alexander Haig was showing signs of failure. The world held its breath. Would there be a war, or would the politicians sort it out before the armed forces took it out of their hands? The answer came in on May the 3rd. During the night, the British submarine Conqueror fired two torpedoes into the 22,000-ton Argentine cruiser, the General Belgrano. The huge ship keeled over and died, taking 368 Argentine sailors to their deaths. The Belgrano was well outside the maritime exclusion zone, but John Knott justified it by saying that she was a threat to the task force, or would have been in a few hours' time. The reply from the Argentines came quickly. Ian MacDonald, the official Ministry of Defence spokesman, was to give out a lot more bad news, but this was his first test.
HMS Sheffield, a Type 42 destroyer, was attacked and hit late this afternoon by an Argentine missile.
Daily reports came in of Argentine aircraft being shot down, of British ships being damaged, of commander raids and of helicopter losses. Where and when would the landings come? IRN's man on the spot was Kim Sabido. He had sailed with the Canberra, and on May the 21st, he was in Port San Carlos.
The scene on the bridge of the Canberra. As a furious battle develops in the air above the bay, British Marines and paratroopers wade ashore. Most met no resistance, but unexpectedly the paratroopers hit two pockets of Argentine troops. One fled, leaving clothing, food and equipment, but not before shooting down two Gazelle helicopters, killing three crewmen. The only casualties among the land forces. The next morning, as jet fighters screamed overhead to the accompanying crash of missiles firing and exploding across the sky, the bridgehead was established and secured.
3,000 British paratroopers and Royal Marines went ashore. In the next week, three more British ships, the Ardent, the Antelope and the Coventry, were sunk in and around Port San Carlos, named by that time Bomb Alley. It seemed like a year before there were any confirmed reports of more action on the Falklands. But when it came on May the 29th, it was dramatic.
The paras pressed on to the south. They met an increasingly strong defensive position, which was well dug in and sighted in depth. And at one stage, they came under particularly intense fire from two heavy machine gun positions. And at this stage, the attack could have faltered. Well up with these leading elements, Colonel Jones immediately took command of a small force and led attack against those machine guns. This attack was carried out with the utmost courage and determination, and it was successful, though sadly, it resulted in the death of Colonel Jones.
The paras buried their dead, including Lieutenant Colonel H. Jones, their commanding officer, who was later awarded the VC posthumously. Again, there was an agonising wait. Five Brigade, the Scots and Welsh Guards and the Gurkhas joined the paras and the Royal Marines. But with the Atlantic conveyor sunk by another Argentine exocet and three giant Chinook helicopters destroyed, the landing ships Sir Tristram and Sir Galahad had to be used to put the troops ashore, and they were caught. Unchallenged, Argentine Mirages attacked and destroyed the Sir Galahad. 51 servicemen died.
Very shortly, Sir Galahad will be taken to sea, where she will become a war grave as a permanent reminder to us and indeed to the world of the lives of all who died in her.
The final battle was close, and our man Kim Sabido was there.
You can hear the bullets now whizzing around us, ricocheting off the rocks. A heavy salvo of small arms fire, machine gun fire coming both down the hill and then up the hill in reply from the British troops ahead of me. More incoming gunfire from Argentine batteries around Stanley, keeping everybody's heads down.
The fighting during the last night was fierce, but the Argentine forces soon had had enough. Mrs. Thatcher told the House of Commons the news herself.
After successful attacks last night, General Moore decided to press forward. The Argentinians retreated. Our forces reached the outskirts of Port Stanley. Large numbers of Argentine soldiers threw down their weapons. They are reported to be flying white flags over Port Stanley. Talks are now in progress between General Menendez and our deputy commander, Brigadier Waters, about the surrender of the Argentine forces on East and West Falkland. Yeah.
The battle won, the troops came home to be welcomed as heroes. Sergeant Ian Mackay joined Lieutenant Colonel Jones on the VC Honours Board, but he also died for his country. The London Gazette read like a series of adventure stories when the awards were handed out. The men had triumphed, their machines, the ships, the planes and the guns came in for some criticism. But Mr. Knott has spent £1,000,000,000 to put that right, and Lord Shackleton told the government how to prevent it happening again. But some didn't come back. 257 gave their lives to free the Falklands from Argentine control.
They shall not grow old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.
We will remember them.
This is the Independent Radio News Review of 1982.
Aldous, 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 all that a great store should be.
Not sitting comfortably? Then snap up a Velda Norway three-piece suite at Aldous Sale starting this Tuesday under half price at £445. Or clean up with a Candy automatic washing machine. Special purchase at only £119. At these prices, you can't afford to miss Aldous Sale. Call 681-2577 for written details of interest-free credit, free delivery and free carpet fitting. See you on Tuesday at your local Aldous.
Aldous, 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 all that a great store should be.
Gold grains, sheepskin and leather, discounts.
Announcing the amazing half-price Moreland sheepskin sale. We have an enormous selection of men's and women's sheepskins at $69.95. Yes, we're selling them at half price. Don't miss this incredible opportunity only at Gold Range, the Big Red Building, 16 to 20 Middlesex Street, the Aldgate End. Open all week and Sunday mornings.
The Big Red Building in Petticoat Lane.
And late night this Thursday.
Welcome back to our review of the year. If 1982 hadn't been the year of the Falklands, I wonder what it would have been the year of. Would it have been the year of the spies? Or another year of the unemployed? Or might it have been the year of the royal baby? Or perhaps the year of one man? The six-day visit of John Paul II, which began on May the 28th, was the first ever by a pope to this country. The whole visit was put in doubt because of the Falklands conflict, but eventually went ahead when the Vatican announced that the pope would also visit Argentina. While he was here, he conducted 14 services and masses, events attended by over 1 million people in England, Scotland, and Wales.
And as long as the memory of this visit lasts, may it be recorded that I, John Paul II, came... The second came to Britain to call you to Christ, to call you to Christ, to invite you to pray.
The Pope at the youth rally in Cardiff's Ninian Park, the last event on his tour, which ended on June the 2nd. And later that same month, we witnessed Britain's biggest ever manhunt, a hunt covered for us by Mike Rowbottom.
Barry Prodham transfixed the whole of the north of England for nearly 2 weeks as he continued to evade capture after killing first a policeman in Harrogate, then a civilian in Lincolnshire, and finally another policeman in Malton. First he took to the forest, then the open fields around the North Yorkshire area. He finally surfaced after expert tracker Eddie McGee pinned him down under a hedge in Malton itself.
I put my hand forward to lift up this probe, and as I put my hand just inside this rough shelter where the wood was, suddenly the foot flew back, and the foot hit me on the knee, sent me sprawling back. And I jumped up in the air, and the officer was over there, and I didn't shout, I said, "He's there."
Prodham had 800 police officers looking for him at one stage, most of them with guns. He was finally cornered after taking a family hostage close to the Malton police station. It ended as it began, with guns.
Reach up guns! The end guns! Now!
Unable to walk, desperately tired and completely surrounded, Prodham took his own life with a single shot from his own pistol.
Just 4 days after the death of Barry Prodham, a quite different story hit the headlines. A man called Michael Fagan paid a visit to the Queen.
The shocking events of 9 July were handled by Her Majesty the Queen with great composure and resolution. But it is intolerable that Her Majesty should have been exposed to this intrusion and put at risk in this way. It is not the wish of Her Majesty, her ministers, or I am sure of this House, that she and other members of the royal family should be confined by measures of high security that deny private life and public acceptability. But the safety of the sovereign must be paramount. There has been an appalling lapse of security.
It was to be an extraordinary time for the palace. Less than a fortnight later, the Home Secretary, William Whitelaw, was back on his feet in the Commons to announce that the Queen's police officer, Commander Michael Trestrail, had resigned after admitting to having a homosexual relationship with a prostitute. Lord Denning, at the age of 83, announced his retirement from the post of Master of the Rolls at the end of the legal year in July. His successor is Lord Justice Donaldson. Earlier in the year, Lord Denning had presided over the Fairs Fair court case, the case which involved the Greater London Council and the Borough of Bromley. Ken Livingstone led the GLC throughout another controversial year, most recently with his invitation to Sinn Féin leaders, which was blocked by the Home Secretary. Other headaches for the government came in the shape of three people: Geoffrey Prime, Rona Ritchie, and Hugh Hambleton. Once again, the quality of Britain's security was brought into question, not least by the United States. Prime, Hambleton, and Ritchie will never bounce back. But there's one man who has every intention of doing just that after a real commercial disaster hit him in February.
I would consider it totally immoral if I didn't get up and have another go, so to speak, because, first of all, not only am I fit commercially, but I'm as fit as a flea physically, you see, and I think that I have a lot to offer. I think I can help the export business. And in addition to that, although I have no legal responsibility to pay those people out there that lost their money buying scheduled air service tickets, I happen to love them, and I want to do my best to help them wherever I can.
And a lot of people out there, as Sir Freddie Laker says, still seem to love him. But another man whose business crashed around him was the man with the Belfast-built, gull-winged car, John DeLorean. His year is ending on a far different note to that of Sir Freddie, out on bail in the United States. The Cortina went this year, and the Sierra arrived. Limeswold and the 20-pence coin were invented. The telegram bit the dust, but the telemessage came over the horizon, and a lady by the name of Koo Stark had some royal connections. Our elected representatives have had a busy little year in Westminster, so I suppose has our political editor Peter Allen.
The Falklands has overshadowed all else at Westminster this year, and it may yet prove to have transformed the landscape of British politics, for that war was the making of Mrs. Thatcher. Before it began, she was the most unpopular Prime Minister since the war. When it ended in British triumph, she enjoyed a massive lead in the opinion polls. And more than that, she seemed to have acquired a stature worth more than any number of policies when it comes to the next election. For the Iron Maiden had led her country through crisis, and she'd won, an outcome which seemed a long way off when she first reported to a hostile House of Commons that the British government, faced with Argentine aggression, had sent a note.
Yesterday was a day of rumour and counter-rumour. Throughout the day, we had no communication from the government of the Falklands. Yesterday morning, at 8:33 a.m., we sent a telegram. At 8...
But the laughter was stilled as the task force sailed, and the Prime Minister seemed to grow more resolute with each day that passed, despite the loss of her Foreign Secretary, Lord Carrington, who took the blame which he did not believe he deserved.
I think the right thing to do is to go and to have somebody fresh here who doesn't suffer from what I believe to be unjustified attacks, but which others clearly do not.
As the negotiations with the Argentinians dragged on and the task force steamed nearer, some had doubts. Just what were we fighting for? What would we do with the Falklands when we won? I suggested to Mrs. Thatcher in an interview that we probably just give them away again.
I beg your pardon? Did you really say that eventually Britain would leave these people to be under the heel of a junta if they did not wish it? Those were words I never thought to hear. We went to defend them. That's what we've gone for. We've gone to get the Argentines off the island. And I hope no one will ever say that British subjects can't look to us to protect them.
In the end, that resolution, thanks to the efforts and sacrifices of the task force, did regain the Falklands. By mid-June, Galtieri was humbled and Mrs. Thatcher ecstatic. The kind of resolve she illustrated did for the unions as well during the year. There's no doubt that the knowledge of her presence at Downing Street has made negotiations in the public sector take a different course. No doubt that the rail workers and the health workers crumbled in the end because it was clear that the Prime Minister wasn't going to give in. She simply opposes all strikes on principle.
I do not believe that people who go on strike in this country have legitimate cause. And throughout both the last government and this, I have never supported any strikes in this country. And I hope even at this late hour, those who are contemplating going on strike will realize that those who they are harming are their fellow citizens.
Employing the same kind of ruthless determination, Mrs. Thatcher seems able to trample on opposition in the Commons and indeed in the Cabinet in the same way. But so far, I've only painted half the picture. for there are problems which don't dissolve before the determination of the lady from Downing Street.
Does not the Right Honourable Lady think that part of the reason for these extremely serious unemployment figures and the increase is the fall of industrial production?
If the Right Honourable Gentleman looks at the figures, he'll find that economic activity is above the levels of last spring. Industrial and manufacturing output is up 2% from spring 1981, and the prospect is for resumed and continued recovery, and this is supported by almost all independent assessments.
That exchange occurred in mid-June, but it was duplicated almost every week. Michael Foot has been obsessed with his own internal party problems. His popularity in the polls remains so low that even some of his friends are in despair. But he has consistently hammered away at this government's great failure, the economy and unemployment. You'll have heard Mrs. Thatcher there talking about the upturn. Well, there's still no sign of it, and still no real idea about how it's going to occur. And because the economic picture remains so obstinately gloomy, the government is finding promises difficult to fulfil. We're not paying less taxes, as promised in the manifesto, but more. And other things have gone wrong, too. Security, for instance, with a man blundering into the Queen's bedroom and a new crop of spies, and the year ended with fresh problems on immigration and the common market. But these are minor problems compared to the economy. It's the recession which could bring down Mrs. Thatcher as she contemplates which date to pick for the next election. That election, by the way, could well occur as early as June. Certainly party workers have been told to be ready by then. Labour does seem to be creeping a little closer in the polls as the year ends, and the alliance, with its feuding over seats ended, will be attempting to set the bandwagon rolling again next year. The depth of our economic plight must give them both hopes that when the election does arrive, they'll win. But their greatest obstacle remains Mrs. Thatcher herself. The lady, as she said, is not for turning.
It's been a busy year for our sportsmen and women in international competition. We've had the World Cup, the Commonwealth Games, and a whole rash of test matches. One man who nearly took a test series on his own, and coincidentally the hearts of many young ladies as well, was the Pakistan captain, Imran Khan. Daley Thompson did more than his bit for us during the year. He's the record holder in the decathlon, and almost inevitably brought home the gold medal from Brisbane. It should have been the year of Coe versus Ovett, but a young man from the northeast of England, Steve Cram, walked off with two gold medals, one from the Commonwealth and the other from the European Games. Alan Wells also did the trick for Scotland, and the Northern Irish footballers turned out to be the surprise team in Spain. It's been a busy year, hasn't it? And there's a lot more to come, from Prince William to Beirut, from the railways to the cinema. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Today's Sunday, for many a day of rest. But some people are getting into good shape for Tuesday.
Ready? And clap high, clap high.
Because low, Tuesday is the start of D.H. Evans' high, biggest sale of the year at Oxford low, Street and Wood Green.
Low, reach up and up.
You'll find genuine low, reductions on all floors and there's interest-free good, credit. So for written low, details, ring 01-629-8800. D.H. Evans' biggest low, sale of the year starts on Tuesday. Oxford Street's low, open 9 till 7.
Well done. Did you get that?
Tomorrow, it starts. Tomorrow, our most gigantic New Year sale ever starts tomorrow at MFI.
New Hygiena bedrooms and kitchens, an unbelievable 60% off. Incredible furniture prices for the lounge, the dining room, the bedroom, the kitchen, the bathroom. For every room in the house, millions of bargains. There's never been a sale on this scale at MFI.
Starts tomorrow, holiday Monday, 10 a.m. Romford starts Tuesday.
9:01 on LBC, the news. Neighbours of a man who died in a flat fire in London say they heard what sounded like a fight and someone shouting, "Don't do it." Three other people were injured in the blaze, including a young woman who jumped naked from a second-floor window to escape the flames. Israel says talks on the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Lebanon will start on Tuesday at a venue to be chosen by the Lebanese government. Earlier, the talks were said to be at risk because of fighting between Christian and Muslim militiamen in the Beirut area. An aging southern Italian landowner has been released by kidnappers who'd held him captive for nearly 5 months. Police say Stefano Pellegrino was in a precarious physical condition after his long captivity. And London's weather today, cloudy, but mainly dry and very mild. This is LBC.
Gold grains, the sheep's skin and leather, discount centre.
Announcing the amazing half-price Moran sheepskin sale. We have an enormous selection of men's and women's sheepskins at $69.95. Yes, we're selling them at half price. Don't miss this incredible opportunity only at Gold Range, the Big Red Building, 16 to 20 Middlesex Street, the Allgate Inn. Open all week and Sunday mornings.
The Big Red Building in Petticoat Lane.
And late night this Thursday.
Right, you have 15 seconds on how many S's in elat starting now.
Sun,
yeah, sun,
lots of sun,
yeah.
Sand,
sand, yeah.
Sea,
yeah.
Safaris, water skiing, yeah. Windsurfing, scuba, skin diving, snorkeling, sailing, 70 degrees, sea fishing.
Sorry, time's up. You missed out quite a bit. Go down to your travel agent and find out more about Elat. It's where the sun takes its winter holiday.
Welcome back to the Independent Radio News Review of the Year. In February, a Tanzanian Boeing 737 was hijacked during an internal flight, with the hijackers demanding the resignation of President Nyerere. The plane flew to Nairobi, Jeddah and Athens before touching down at Stansted.
We have explosives on board and my friends are fully armed. So I wouldn't like to have any military activity.
Let's take it step by step. At the moment, hold and await instructions from us. If we can get approval for you to move, then we will give you precise instructions.
We have already wasted enough time. This is Lieutenant Colonel speaking. We are moving now.
The plane never did leave the ground, and after 26 hours, the hijackers, who had their families aboard, surrendered. Five Tanzanians were later jailed for a total of 27 years. The Helen Smith affair ran throughout the year, and it's still not finished. Our man who's covered that story is Tim Crook.
Former policeman Ron Smith maintained that dead men tell no stories, but their bodies do. He always believed that the body of his daughter Helen was the key to the mystery about her death. The world's top pathologists had picked over her skin and bones with scientific scrutiny, and they all assembled at Leeds Town Hall in November at her inquest to present their findings. Was Helen's death, along with a Dutchman in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, accident or unlawful killing? Party host Richard Arnott was there, so were many of the guests. The inquest jury were undecided. They said open verdict, and Ron Smith refused to present his evidence of what he called the anatomy of double murder. So did his crusade end in failure?
Everyone in this land will say, people who are not aware of the fact, will say, well, it's tough luck on Ron Smith. He was a good father, and by God, he was a fighter, a good struggler fighter, typical Yorkshire grit.
The inquest left many unanswered questions, and party hostess Penny Arnott and the man she made love to at the party, Timothy Hayter, were conspicuous by their absence.
The anti-nuclear movement gained momentum with the prospect of the cruise missile being based in Britain. 30,000 people ringed the Greenham Common Air Base, and many cities throughout Europe saw protest rallies. Inevitably, and I must say it's a sad sign of the times that we use that word, 1982 has seen a number of bomb atrocities both in Northern Ireland and on the mainland of Britain.
Carnage, a horse trying to get up and not understanding why it can't stand on three legs. An officer that had been married 3 weeks and was lying there dead. A trooper in my troop who had been married 4 weeks and was lying there dead. A corporal major who basically taught me when I first joined up 9 years ago, lying there in one hell of a mess. Me, the fact that I was alive and couldn't believe it, somebody was looking after me. Horses running everywhere, screaming everywhere.
Hyde Park, July the 20th. 11 people died in that horror and in the bandstand bombing in London's Regent's Park. Many more have died in Northern Ireland. that part of the United Kingdom which can still see no end in sight for its troubles. Our reporter, John Draper, looks back at the Northern Irish year.
If the people of Northern Ireland didn't enter 1982 with any great optimism, most were certainly grateful to see the end of 1981, the year of the May's prison hunger strikes, with the resulting deaths inside and outside the H blocks. However, that year left a legacy, both in terms of further polarisation and because the H Block campaign resulted in a major change in the political scene, with the rise of provisional Sinn Féin, the IRA's political wing. There was no expectation the violence would ease in 1982, and it didn't. By mid-December, 96 people, including 40 members of the security forces, had died and about 460 injured. Despite, and indeed because of the violence, Secretary of State James Pryor pressed ahead with a political initiative, Rolling Devolution. The idea was that direct rule from Westminster would gradually be replaced by an elected assembly at Stormont, provided cross-community support could be demonstrated for this. However, the Nationalists opposed the plan because it fell short of power-sharing and because there was no major role for the Irish Republic. And the Unionists either feared it would lead to a weakening of the link with Great Britain or because it didn't provide for simple majority rule. When the elections came in October, however, most parties put up candidates, including for the first time provisional Sinn Féin. They were spurred on by the success the previous year of H-Block candidates in council elections and of Bobby Sands and later Owen Caron in the Fermanagh South Tyrone by-elections. Both the mainly Catholic, Social Democratic and Labour Party and Sinn Féin fought on abstentionist tickets, and although the SDLP increased their vote, they and most other observers were taken aback when Sinn Féin took 5 of the 78 seats. Gerry Adams, their leader, was asked if the vote gave the IRA a mandate for violence.
I don't think the IRA needed a mandate or needs a mandate when the country's partitioned, when the British are occupying 6 counties of it. That's mandate enough for any man or woman who wants to resist by force of arms.
On the Loyalist side, the official Unionists came out on top, stemming the advance of Ian Paisley's Democratic Unionist Party, a trend begun earlier in the year when they held the East Belfast constituency in a Westminster by-election caused by the murder the previous November of official Unionist Robert Bradford. When the Assembly opened last month, only the Unionist parties and the Non-Sectarian Alliance Party took their seats, and as the violence continued, security dominated the proceedings. In particular, the carnage at Ballykelly, when an Irish National Liberation Army bomb claimed 17 lives and injured 65 others. The explosion came just the day after it was revealed Labour members of the Greater London Council had invited a Sinn Féin delegation to London, a visit subsequently banned by the Home Secretary. Speaking from the scene of the Ballykelly outrage, Loyalist leader Ian Paisley articulated the views of many people on both sides of the Irish Sea about the Sinn Féin visit.
When they think of Morrison and Adams being invited over to London to be wined and dined by Ken Livingstone and received at the House of Commons, I think that is an absolute outrage at this time.
The security drive against terrorism continued, and a new word entered the Ulster lexicon, the supergrass, a terrorist who agreed to give evidence against others involved in violence. South of the border, security services uncovered a number of arms dumps, although Unionists claimed the Republic was running down border patrols. However, history was made when Brixton jail escaper Gerard Tewart was sentenced in Dublin to 10 years for bombings in London, and a recent court ruling may have opened up the possibility of extradition for terrorists. It remains to be seen whether the replacement of Charles Haughey's Fianna Fáil government by a Fine Gael Labour coalition leads to improved Anglo-Irish relations. In Northern Ireland, where economic prospects are as gloomy as those for peace and political stability, there's as little optimism at the end of 1982 as at the beginning.
John Draper. Our reporters have travelled far and wide this year, from the decks of the Canberra in San Carlos Water to the dusty, dangerous streets of war-torn Beirut.
Just before dawn, buildings shook and the sky turned yellow and orange as ceasefire number 8, just over 30 hours old, broke down. A bombardment of shells from warships to the west and Israeli artillery in the hills of the east blitzed West Beirut. When the sun did rise, it couldn't penetrate through a fog of black and grey dust and smoke.
Nobody is going to bring Israel to her knees. You must have forgotten. The Jews do not kneel but to God.
79 days. Facing the hell with these people, with the children, with the women. And no power moved to stop them. Except our flesh, our blood. It's shameful.
The sound you can hear isn't a gun battle, but the Palestinian guerrillas celebrating the evacuation of some of the first wave of guerrillas down in the port area of Beirut.
Phil Longman and Andrew Simmons covered that war, a war which seemed to have ended when the PLO left the Lebanon. But the world was soon to be shocked by the massacre at the refugee camps of Sabra and Chatila. Peggy Riley visited the Palestinian camps.
I'll never forget what I saw at the Palestinian refugee camp. Men, women, and children, their bodies stacked up in piles. The way some fell suggests they were trying to flee from their attackers. It was a pathetic, gruesome sight. Many of those people who died had just recently returned to the camps. While the multinational force was still in Beirut, they had felt safe enough to return, even though the fighters that had at one time offered them some measure of protection were gone. And not only were these murders, but there was evidence of rape, mass executions. There were mutilations. I saw arms, legs sticking out of the rubble. Some bodies had had their throats slashed.
That event was just one of the many which occupied the minds and the time of the American leadership.
Looking back on 1982 from an American perspective, it's ironic how many of the important events actually occurred outside the United States, but because the country's role as a superpower managed to involve the U.S. directly. There was, of course, the Falklands dispute, with the then Secretary of State, Mr. Alexander Haig, successfully convincing a doubting President Reagan to rally to Britain's side. A few weeks later, Alexander Haig resigned, or, as he put it, was pushed to be replaced by the less flamboyant George Shultz. It was a year in which the Reagan administration imposed sanctions on companies supplying equipment for the Russian gas pipeline, and then, following the death of the Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev, did an about-turn. Balance of forces between East and West was very much on Mr. Reagan's mind in 1982 as he sought the American Congress's approval for his new MX nuclear missile system.
Our most pressing problem today is that the Soviet Union, because of its massive buildup of nuclear weapons, could destroy virtually all of our land-based missiles in a single nuclear attack. If we do nothing to correct that situation, we will have weakened the chances for peace.
During the year, President Reagan had to contend with mounting criticism of his economic policies as unemployment soared. But the news wasn't entirely dominated by diplomacy or the recession. In Chicago, seven people died after swallowing an aspirin substitute, Tylenol, which had been deliberately laced with cyanide. And in Los Angeles, the motoring tycoon John DeLorean appeared in court charged in connection with a multi-$1 million drug deal. 1982 saw the reusable space shuttle gain recognition as a reliable form of space transport. And in Utah, the first mechanical heart was successfully implanted into a human recipient, bringing with it, despite anticipated setbacks, a message of hope for thousands of heart sufferers in 1983. Andrew Mandelstam, IRN, Washington.
Andrew, of course, spends most of his working life in the United States. But it is often the lot of a reporter to find him or herself in a strange country with little or no time for preparation. And there could have been few stranger countries to be in this year, certainly for a British reporter, than Argentina, at the time when our troops were sailing south. The person who did that for us was Antonia Higgs.
Looking back on 3 months spent covering my own country's war from supposed enemy territory, the whole experience seems quite bizarre. Not least because President Galtieri, in his wisdom, actually allowed us to stay for the whole duration of the fighting. When I left London, Falklands fever was just beginning to build up. What a contrast with the Malvinas madness that had already gripped Buenos Aires.
I'm Argentine. To Malvinas is Argentine. Only Argentine. Mrs. Thatcher. I don't speak about Mr. Thatcher.
In Malvinas, the land is Argentine.
Away from the demonstrations, the riots and the hysteria, the Argentine people treated the British press with quite amazing consideration and understanding. There were threats and ugly incidents, but only one small section of the society was involved. The surrender at Stanley and the end of the war was an uneasy time for everyone. A people who'd been so badly let down by a government who'd assured them that they could hold on to the islands were in no mood to answer the queries of journalists. They took to the streets to protest, and though most of the anger was vented against the military, there were warnings that Britain would do well to remember now.
Maybe Puerto Argentino is going to surrender, but the war is not going to stop. The war is still on.
In Poland, solidarity was outlawed in October, an act which brought another round of riots in Warsaw. Solidarity's leader, Lech Wałęsa, was released from detention after 11 months. By Christmas, all the detainees had been released, and the military were preparing to hand back most of their powers to the Communist Party. And in the Persian Gulf, Iran and Iraq continued to fight. And still outside our shores, but this time only just, a rotting, silted-up old wreck saw the light of day for the first time in 437 years.
And as the first Mary Rose timbers break through the Solent, a greeting from hundreds of ships horned around here, and a gun salute from Southsea Castle. It really does look like they've got her this time. And we've been joined by Alex McKee, the man who first found the Mary Rose. Alex, seeing the timbers for the first time, you must recognise these like old friends.
Oh, that's right. So many times since God knows when, you know.
You're listening to the Independent Radio News Review of the Year.
Lillywhites presents Great Moments in Sport. Here we are, ladies and gentlemen, for the start of the first big sports event of the year, the Lillywhites Winter Sale. All the big names in sport, all the bargains you've been waiting for. The sales staff are in position, the customers are lining up, the clock is ticking down. What a scene! Where? At Lillywhites at Alders of Croydon. Doors open December the 28th at 9 a.m. sharp. Don't miss it.
In our news review of 1982, we've travelled far and wide. But let me now come back to Britain, a Britain with economic problems and more than 3 million people unemployed. The man who's covered those stories for us, in his role as industrial editor, is John Perkins.
1982 will go down as the year when two rail leaders met their Waterloo, as the year when unemployment hit its highest ever level, and as the year which saw the longest national bout of industrial action since World War II. In addition, Mr. Arthur Scargill suffered a massive reversal at the hands of his members in his first year as president of the National Union of Mine Workers, and a new word entered the English language, courtesy of the TUC. The most dramatic event was probably the comprehensive defeat of Mr. Arthur Scargill in the miners' ballot on pay. To whip up support, Mr. Scargill launched a grand tour of the coalfields. And when we spoke to him after such a rally in South Wales, he oozed confidence.
The support that I've had tonight and the National Executive have had tonight has been absolutely superb. Over 2,500 people here, a terrific response in support of the union. If that's reflected, I'm sure it will be all over Britain. We shall win this vote.
At the vote, though, he proved disastrously wrong, as the miners defied him and his executive and took the money instead. The early part of the year had been taken up with a toe-to-toe slugging match between British Rail and the train drivers' union, ASLEF, led by Mr. Ray Buckton. The dispute centred ostensibly on flexible rostering, and it caused massive disruption as the entire railway system was closed down for days on end. Eventually, though, it was the TUC which broke the deadlock after a marathon 25-hour session. They decided they could no longer support ASLEF, and soon afterwards the drivers gave in. Not surprisingly, it was a bitter Ray Buckton who admitted defeat.
This matter was one of great principle to the trade union labour movement. It was a matter of principle because here we have the management of a big nationalised industry imposing conditions of service without using the authorised and proper agreed machinery to introduce something. And also the fact that this would have meant, whatever they want to do, getting rid of 4,000 people, more especially when for the first time in history we saw management of a big industry wanting to sack every member of a trade union, the whole membership of a trade union, to sack them. This is the first time that's happened. And quite frankly, I would have thought that the trade union movement of this country would have reacted just a little better than they did.
For another prominent rail union leader, Mr. Sidney Weel, 1982 also proved dramatic. He eventually lost his job after a long period of wrangling with his executive. He suddenly announced his resignation. By many, it was seen as a device to smash the left-wing element. A delegate conference was called in Birmingham, and it was anticipated they would ask Mr. Weel to think again, thereby restoring him as the undisputed head of the union. But it all went wrong.
The decision has been taken by the governing body of my union. It's a majority decision. I accept it, and I will be retiring in accordance with the rule in about 12 weeks' time.
Are you disappointed, Mr. Weel?
Well, let me put it like this. I've served this union all my life, and yes, certainly I could. I'd be less than honest if I didn't say I was disappointed.
The health service dispute provided an equally dramatic moment when in September an estimated 60,000 people joined in a rally in Hyde Park in support of the million nurses and ancillary workers struggling for more pay. The dispute itself lingered for 8 whole months, making it the longest-running national dispute since the last war. The end, though, took just 1 hour. It came at a meeting of the TUC's Health Services Committee at Congress House. The other statistic which marked or marred 1982 was unemployment. In January, it rose for the first time since the 1930s to over 3 million, and in September, it rose to its current record level of 3,343,000, a figure not likely to be challenged in the near future because the government's now introduced a new way of calculating the figure. And there finally came into the language a new word. It was coined at this year's TUC Congress in Brighton, and it means every union over a certain size will now have the automatic right to membership of the General Council, and that word, automaticity.
1982 was information technology year. Computers aren't strange things in air-conditioned rooms anymore. They're in our schools, and increasingly in our homes as well. Television is changing. We've got a fourth channel, although some say that we shouldn't have. Cable TV is now on a semi-distant horizon, and direct broadcasting by satellite is more than a gleam in the eye. And another extraterrestrial is with us. E.T. is already attracting huge audiences to the cinema, despite the fears that pirated video recordings of the film would severely damage the cinema's profits. Major world figure died this year.
This is Moscow. The Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR, and the Council of Ministers of the USSR deeply regret to announce the sudden death on November the 10th, 1982, of the General Secretary of the Central Committee and the Chairman of the Presidium of the USSR Supreme Soviet, Leonid Brezhnev.
Lord Butler, Rab to most of us, died in March. Douglas Bader died in September, while in August the world lost two royal figures, King Sobhuza of Swaziland, the world's longest reigning monarch, and Princess Grace in that tragic car crash. And the world of entertainment is the poorer at the end of 82. It has lost Thelonious Monk, Kenneth Moore, Ingrid Bergman, Henry Fonda, and Arthur Lowe. It's also lost that Arthur with a big heart.
Big-hearted Arthur, they call me. Big-hearted Arthur, that's me. Clean if I'm not very clever, but only because I've got to be. I've told my best stories and tried hard to please. I've acted in sketches and sung songs with ease. The only thing left is to do my striptease. Big-hearted Arthur, they call me. Big-hearted Arthur, they call me.
The concert pianist Arthur Rubinstein died shortly before Christmas at the age of 95. Kathleen Nesbitt died in August. She was 93. Stanley Holloway left us at the age of 91. And Chesney Allen, the last survivor of the Crazy Gang, died in November.
Underneath the arches, we dream our dreams away. Underneath the arches, on cobblestones we lay. Every night you'll find us tired out and worn, happy when the daylight comes creeping, heralding the dawn, sleeping when it's raining.
A member of a much more modern Crazy Gang also died this year, that man with the pop eyes, Marty Feldman. Harry H. Corbett, the son of Steptoe, also left us, as did the man who gladdened many a scout's heart with his gang show, Ralph Reeder. In 1982, a child was born. Well, more than one, I suppose, but the one I'm referring to was born at 9:03 in the evening of June the 21st at St. Mary's Hospital, Paddington. He weighed 7 pounds, 1.5 ounces, and was later to be christened William Arthur Philip Louis. Yes, folks, Daddy and Mummy were the Prince and Princess of Wales, and Prince William entered the world.
Obviously relieved and delightful. His smile is... it's rather a grown-up thing, I find. Rather a shock to my sister. He's in marvellous form.
Does the baby have any hair?
He looks marvellous. Yes. Fair. Sort of blondish.
Who does he look like, sir? You or his mother?
I can't tell yet.
Is he the prettiest...
no idea.
Is he the prettiest baby in the world?
Well, he's not bad.
They have been singing, Well Done Charlie, Let's Have Another One.
Really?
On the programme of events.
Bloody hell, give us a chance. You ask my wife, I don't think she'd be too pleased just yet. Now, I tell you what.
Congratulations,
sir. Tell you
sir.
Be very kind and somehow ask them not to make too much noise when I've gone. Some sleep is badly needed.
You see, it's not been a totally bad year, has it? Why, do you know, we even won 4 Oscars, including that of Best Picture for that British success, Chariots of Fire. And one of the best quotes of the year came from the film's writer, Colin Welland. Have a good 1983.
What you've done for the British film industry. I'd just like to thank David Putnam for having the wisdom to ask me to write it in the first place. All the actors for getting fit enough to appear like Olympic athletes, and to British television, where I learned my craft. I'd like to finish with a word of warning. You may have started something. The British are coming.
News Review of 1982 was presented by Douglas Cameron. The engineer was Paul Easton, and the program was researched and produced by Charlie Rose and Robin Malcolm.
This is LBC News Radio.
Today's Sunday, for many a day of rest. But some people are getting into good shape for Tuesday.
Ready?